We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers.
Few recording artists over the years have hit number one nationally with their first two chart records, but today's guest did just that. Welcome to the show, Tiffany.
Hello.
Well, it's a pleasure to be talking to you, and we're going to spend the next few moments talking about your career then and now, with then being in the late 80s, now being... Well, what is it now? Let me see. Let me just check my calendar. 2011. Right. At the outset, I'm going to recommend that people visit your website, which is...
TiffanyTunes.com, so everybody can go and check that out. New album, always touring information there, and just tons of stuff.
Great.
Of what's going to go on in my life this year, next year. It's so funny because I always look around and say, well, let me go to the website myself and figure it all out.
And you have to say Tiffany Tunes, because I guess www.tiffany.com probably was not available.
Probably not. I didn't really think about it too much, to be honest with you. We had a couple of Tiffany Music. We had a couple of different things. I like things with a little flavor and character, and that's something that says a little bit more. One of my production companies is called Only the Girl. And that's pretty much how it's been for the last, 10 years of my life, especially.
Yeah.
It's just been just me, so.
And I like alliteration, like Tiffany Tunes.
It ties in the whole songwriting aspect.
Right.
I started writing songs and really showing them to people and put them on records about 10 years ago. That is a growing business for me, and I love songwriting, and I'm here in Nashville. So
yeah.
I always, you know, hope that somebody will find one of my tunes and hope to cut it.
You grew up in Norwalk, California?
Yes, about 30 minutes south of Los Angeles.
Your age is not a big deal. People pretty much know you were born in 1971, right? It's not a big secret.
Yeah, great year.
You may have become the first female artist to ever hit number one with your first two charted records. Now, Mariah Carey eventually did it, but she came later.
Right. I was definitely younger, so
definitely.
There's that factor there, because I was 15 when the album came out, like right before my 16th birthday. Everything just exploded for me, so it was a great birthday present.
Oh, it had to be. It had to be. Now, actually, you were 4 years old when you started singing a song called Delta Dawn,
right,
which became popular by both Tanya Tucker and Helen Reddy. Tanya Tucker had it on the country chart originally. Helen Reddy covered it and hit number one with it.
That was a song that I used to sing everywhere I went, and I drove my family nuts. And the joke is, as always, I'm like, well, I'm glad the singing thing worked out, because, you know, my poor family, I really put them through a lot. They couldn't sit down to a family dinner. We couldn't go to dinner out, you know, in public, the grocery store. I was constantly singing and performing. So if I wasn't dancing in the aisles, I started off as a dancer. And if I wasn't doing some number down the aisles at the supermarket, I was singing to the high heavens. So, you know, my mom was constantly telling me, no, honey, please, no.
If she gave
me candy, my grandfather, I would interrupt his, you know, 5 o'clock news all the time. And he'd always give me candy or donuts or something that was in the cupboard or anything. He'd call my grandmother. So it's so funny now when I sing. A lot of times after a show, especially if I've done a really good job, I'm like, I feel like candy, or I feel like a donut, and I never really put it together, but it's old school. It's my grandfather feeding me. There's that comfort food connection.
Wow. Let me ask you this about Delta Dawn. Did you actually learn it from the Tanya Tucker record or the Helen Reddy record?
I learned it from Tanya Tucker.
Which is kind of appropriate, because in 1981, you debuted as a singer with country music singer Jack Reeves. And before I go any further, I want to say a big shout-out to Jack Reeves, without whom this interview wouldn't have been possible, because he's the one that put me in touch with you. So thank you so much, Jack Reeves. Also, for putting me in touch with Jack Reeves, there was a gentleman named Dan Keenan. How you doing, Dan? Now that we got that out of the way, tell me a little bit about Jack Reeves and your first appearance as a singer. You passed the hat and you collected some money?
Well, yeah. I was only 9 when I first met Jack?
Yeah.
And at that time, it was something that, you know, kind of the backstory was my mom had remarried. My stepfather had his own business. He was a mercenary, I guess. Is that the right term? Where you build buildings with brick? I should know this, right? Masonry.
Masonry.
Not a mercenary. What's a mercenary?
Take two. Okay. Masonry.
Masonry. What is a mercenary? Does it even exist? Anyway, you know, it's early in the morning for me.
It's fine.
I'm a musician, so without coffee, I can't really think. So my dad had his own business, and, you know, he was very reluctant to really kind of take on this music industry. But, again, I wouldn't shut up, and I was always singing in my bedroom. And he kind of thought, well, you know, is this something you really want to do? So he tested me out at a party. We had some friends across the street who were musicians, and they were having this big kickoff party because they were going out on the road. And my dad thought, well, she won't get up and sing in front of strangers. You know, this is just really nothing to discuss. And I did. I got up and I sang, and people were really shocked that I really had a voice. So my dad sat me down and he said, is this something that you really want to do? And I said, definitely. So he started taking me around country clubs, country hoedowns,
right,
barbecues, anywhere there was a live band.
I see.
And somehow he came across Jack Reeves, and I met Jack, and he has a daughter named Jackie, who's around my same age. So, of course, I was more interested in Jackie at the time than Jack, because it was a playmate for me. And we used to hang out and sing together and then go play and just, you know, do girl stuff.
Wow.
But, I mean, it took me a long time as I grew up to really have, like, a friendship with Jack as I started to be more of a musician.
Right.
And understand, you know, the whole touring side of it and playing in front of an audience and everything. It was funny because Jackie grew up, she got married, she had kids, and so did I. But I kept in contact with her dad more, and Jack is just such a warm-hearted person. He set me out on the road to do my first actual, like, touring experience. He set
what?
Me to Anchorage, Alaska. I did Kenai, Alaska, and I did Yukon, and so, you know, I was 10 years old when I set out to do my first real tour, and I was 3 weeks in Alaska under Tiffany Renee. So the start really happens with Jack Reeves.
Your actual first gig with him, according to what I've read here, was at a place called Narod's in Chino, California?
Yes, I moved back to Chino many, many years later, and there was a place called Chino Downs there.
So.
And it was in the hills. I'm coming from Norwalk, which we didn't have any hills or anything like that. It was all flatlands and tons of buildings.
So
to me, that was like the big time country out there.
This was like your first gig where you actually got paid something, where you passed the hat with the crowd afterwards?
Yeah. I mean, all that kind of stuff is always a blur to me, because all the, like, little details, all I know is I got to sing. Great people were there. There was always some barbecue served up somewhere and tables where you could chat and spend time with each other after. And then you get up and you do the thing you love. And it was really awesome and simple and warm people. And they did used to pass the hat around.
Right.
And that went to gas money, and my mom would make all my costumes. So, you know, that kind of paid for that. But the first, you know, couple of times we were out doing it, we didn't expect any money. That was kind of like, oh, okay, whatever. You could never really expect that. That was a spontaneous thing. Somebody out of their kindness of their heart would tip their hat and throw it around for the band.
Well, you got something like $235, and that would be your first career earnings, according
to
this.
That was it.
$235. And then kind of, I guess, after Jack discovered you, Boyd Axton and his mom, May Boren Axton, I think was her full name,
yes,
discovered you, and May took you to sing in Nashville, Tennessee, and you actually got on the renowned Ralph Emery Show.
Right.
And you remember the song you sang? It was a Juice Newton song that she had a hit right.
Oh, Queen of Hearts, and I sang also Your Good Girl's Gonna Go Bad.
Tammy Wynette, yes. You did a lot of stuff before becoming an overnight success.
I did. Well, I mean, I love to sing. My stepfather did it out of the kindness of his heart, you know, just kind of trying to help me fulfill my dream.
Right.
And my family definitely had support for it, because I was going to, again, torture them in the living room anyway. So this way I was out during the weekend singing for others and they had a break. Yeah. But it was a great experience. I mean, I've always loved singing. I've always loved performing. The business side of it and, you know, being on my first TV show, all of that was always, what is this about?
You're 10, 11 years old. This is incredible. And you're performing on the same bill as Jerry Lee Lewis and George Jones touring Alaska. You met a man somewhere along the line by the name of George Tobin. He initially became your manager, right?
My manager, my producer. I think I met George when I was 14.
He heard you on a demo tape somewhere along the line.
I had come to Nashville when I was 10, and May Axton brought me out here, and we kind of pounded the pavement to see, you know, if there was a label deal, who was interested. I did the Ralph Emery show. I did kind of like the circuit. I did my first fanfare. Back then they called it fanfare. And I was Tiffany Renee, and people were like, May, she's great, but she's 10. And we don't want to sign a 10-year-old right now. Keep her plugging away. And my parents had a business in California. My mom was pregnant when we came to town here in Nashville. So, you know, real life kept us going back to California. I was doing country music and doing a lot of country music demos and just kind of growing a little bit as an artist with all hopes to come back to Nashville. That's when I met George Tobin. I was actually in his studio recording a country and western demo, and he heard me, and he pulled me to the side and sat me on the couch and said, do you know any Beatles songs? And I was like, who is this person? And I started singing some Beatles songs with him, and basically, you know, at that time, my mom and my dad, we were moving, so I had moved with my real father for a second, and I was still living in Norwalk, and, you know, again, real life happened, so I was living with my real dad, and he did not want me in the music industry at all.
Oh, really?
And so when I first met George, you know, it took a little courting period. There was maybe about a year or so where we kept in contact, and I was with my dad, and I went into the acting world and went and pounded the pavement there just because I begged him so much. He was like, I'm really not a big fan of this, but I'll take you to acting class. And I'll get you some headshots if you really like this, but I really don't want you to pursue the arts because I think it'll break your heart. But, you know, he was all for the training part of it. And then that's when I moved back with my mom, and George was still in our lives, and I had dated George's son for a second. And when George started talking to my mom and saying, your daughter really has something. I mean, she really could do something, but I'm not interested in country. I'm interested in the pop market. And that was kind of a stumbling block for my mom. And even for me, because I'm a huge Stevie Nicks fan. And so I was interested in doing kind of a blend of country with an edge to it.
Kind of an edge,
the pop music to me was all the people that I loved and bought records for, which was Lisa Lisa and the Call Jam and all of that. But I never really, as a vocalist, ever saw myself doing that. So George had a hard time convincing me to record I Think We're Alone Now. I really didn't want to record that song.
This is Ronnie Allen. I'm talking to Tiffany. Boy, you've told me so much in so little time. It's just amazing. 1986 was a pivotal year for you. I could say for better or for worse, because there were good and bad associated with this. You signed a contract that gave George Tobin total control pretty much over your career. But he did get you the recording deal at MCA Records, right?
He did. We had a couple of labels recording us. He chose to go with MCA, and, I mean, it all worked out. I mean, the contract with George, my mom, definitely, that was way over my head. I was only 14, so.
Right.
And my mom is not real savvy when it comes to the music industry at all. I don't think a lot of parents are. That's why when people come to me and they ask me, my daughter wants to sing, I say, well, try to get as educated as you can, but don't be difficult when you get that opportunity. Be humble with all that knowledge. Know that you don't know everything. And it's a great opportunity. But, you know, this is an industry, like any business, that's exactly what it is. And the more that you know, the more that, A, you'll feel good about yourself, be able to talk shop with everybody, but also you can't go back and say, you did me wrong. To somebody who's like, well, it's not my fault, you didn't know. And this business counts on that a lot. So you have to really realize that. And that's kind of the case with my mom. She signed a contract that gave up pretty much everything, all of our control to George.
To George, yes.
Which, you know, at that time, I mean, it worked. It definitely worked. And later on, of course, I had people in my ear saying, this isn't right, and blah, 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 and he's really taking advantage of you, and all of these different things. And, you know, none of that really ever mattered to me. Even now, I mean, money is great. Success is awesome. I'm very much a people person, and I enjoy that respect, and there's a value system to me. And so, you know, George comes from a different school. He comes from the dollar amount. Well, there's the money, you know, and however we achieve that money doesn't matter because that is success. And it's so strange because we were speaking two different languages for most of our life, and that's why we ended up parting ways. It wasn't really all the ins and outs of the business and who did what wrong or whatever. No, we're very successful people, but we've broken down our relationship together. Right. When I talk, you don't hear me. This is a problem.
George Tobin was kind of to you what Colonel Parker was to Elvis.
Oh, definitely.
So
definitely.
There is,
I mean, there wouldn't have been
here,
a Tiffany without a George Tobin.
Were you, when you appeared on TV shows, were you just appearing as Tiffany, or were you still Tiffany Renee?
I was Tiffany Renee. I didn't become Tiffany until I had my record deal. They were saying, well, what do we call you? Tiffany Renee is way too country. Tiffany Darwish, which is my maiden name, is just very complicated. Tiffany Williams, I didn't want to call myself Tiffany Williams, which is my stepfather's name, out of respect for my dad, my real father, and I pretty much looked at everybody and said, what about this Tiffany? Like,
it's
kind of my name, and you call me that, I'll come, so it'll be pretty easy. And, you know, it took a second for everybody to think about it, but that's how I became just one name.
And you released, there's a word called eponymous, E-P-O-N-Y-M-O-U-S, which means actually self-titled. I think that's what that means. You spent a lot of time coming up with the title of your first album, which was, in fact, Tiffany. Now, actually, I Think We're Alone Now was not the first single released from that album. You had a single out called Danny, Nobody Wins.
I did. Our first single was Danny, Nobody Wins, which was what the label picked, and it wasn't doing well. We had tested it at radio, and it was failing miserably.
Can we hear a little bit of it anyway, just to let people hear what it sounds
like? Sure.
By Tiffany.
Danny, Nobody Wins. Yes.
Oh, I love it when people I interview actually sing live. So Danny didn't quite make it. Did that discourage you at all?
Well, it wasn't really a failure because we pulled it, and again, this was George. He saw it going downhill. It was being tested at radio. It wasn't really taking off. But he made a big transition before it really had a chance to bomb and be like, well, your first single totally tanked. he pulled it, and he went and tested separately without the label, I Think We're Alone Now, and just kind of pushed the issue and started making it happen. So the switch was pretty quick, you know, and it was very successful.
Well, that song, of course, had been tested because it became a huge hit for Tommy James and the Shondells, and the writer of the song was Richie Cordell. I guess you were familiar with the Tommy James and the Shondells record when you recorded it, right?
Well, I had been given a copy.
Right.
And again, when George said, I want to record, I Think We're Alone Now, here's, you know, a copy of the original, it just I must have looked at him like, are you crazy? Because it didn't sound obviously very modern, and it was kind of not what we had talked about at all. I mean, originally, I want to do country music. Then the next thing I know, we're talking about doing pop music, and then he hands me, I think we're alone now, Tommy James and the Shondells.
Right. But you did.
So I'm going, what is going on?
Right.
I came back the next day, and he goes, just trust me. And he had the track done to I Think We're Alone Now, which, again, I had a conflict with because it was so dance and it was so pop. I'm thinking, well, I'm not sure that people are going to know that I can even sing. And I'm just not sure that this is what I want to be really known for. This is not Stevie Nicks.
So I went home
and played it for my friends, and they started dancing around the room with it and loved it. And so, of course, I came back the next day going, well, I want to be cool, and they seem to like it, and I don't know everything, and I'm just going to sing songs.
And you did, and guess what happened? It actually did something that even the Tommy James record didn't do. It went to number one on the chart. Now, by Tiffany. And I guess over a period of time, you kind of got to like that record, I would assume, because of how well it did.
Well, I did. I mean, I liked it after I recorded it. You know, after I sing something, it's a whole different vibe. I put my heart into doing the vocal. And, you know, it was kind of, again, I saw right off the bat how that song makes people happy. It's a weird deal, and it sounds very cheesy to say that, but it's true.
It is true.
People are like tapping their toe and singing the lyrics right off the bat. It's a very easy song to just kind of adapt to. So for me, it wasn't a hard sell after I'd done the vocal, and then as it started taking off and I'm touring, singing I Think We're Alone Now, and just watching, you know, people and my dream getting bigger than I had ever imagined, it's an awesome feeling.
And speaking of an awesome feeling, you became kind of the queen of the shopping malls. Now, how did that happen? Is that fair to call you that? I mean, I'm not saying that in any way.
Oh, no. That is my title, and I had a great time in the shopping mall. I have a mean shopping habit because of all of the shopping mall experience. You know, again, Danny Nobody Wins had come out, and I Think We're Alone Now, and that was doing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of struggling a little bit as far as going to the other side. What was happening was, where do you put me as an artist? I'm 15 and a half, about to be 16, and they brought me out to New York. I did a lot of clubs in Jersey and in New York, and it failed miserably. A, I wasn't old enough to even be in the clubs.
So?
The audience were 18 to 21.
I see.
So I didn't bond with those people, and that was a problem, because now live dates, where do we put her as far as exposure for the record so people, you know, take it to the next level?
Shopping malls.
Well, MCA was actually going to drop me because they thought, you know.
Even though the record was a hit?
Well, the record wasn't entirely a hit yet. It was the shopping malls that made the record and radio really just take off like wildfire. And then you had a face, because of all the media around the shopping malls, you had a face to identify the record with. And it was Larry Salters over at MCA who thought of the mall tour. His project over at MCA was, you know, going to die a horrible death. And
Larry Salters is the man responsible
for
making you the mall girl.
Yes. I will forever have that title because of Larry Salters. I am grateful.
You kicked off the tour, I think, at the Bergen Mall in Paramus, New Jersey, and I've gone there many times. I grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey, so I'm very much familiar with Paramus, New Jersey. I also interviewed recently Dean Friedman, who sang a song about Paramus, New Jersey. He did call it Ariel. That was the first one of many, Bergen Mall in Paramus, New Jersey.
Yes.
The thing is, you have a number one hit record. The next record was going to be absolutely crucial. You either keep the momentum or you don't keep the momentum. And the next one was a total change of pace called Could Have Been. Who wrote the song?
Lois Blaish.
Was she a friend of yours?
No, these were all songwriters that George knew, and he would find these great songs. I actually think that at that time I was managed by George Tobin and Brad Schmidt, who was George's partner. And so Brad would go out to a lot of showcases and look at songwriters, and he found Could Have Been, and he brought Could Have Been to us.
What was your reaction to Could Have Been? Did you like it immediately?
I loved the song immediately. Being a singer, I love anything that's going to really show that I can sing. I'm a melancholy by heart. So I love sad songs, and it was a tad country, to be honest with you.
Yes, it was. It could have been pushed as a country record.
Definitely. I fell in love with it immediately, and I love the storyline. Even though I was 14, I had had already boyfriends and major breakups, and my heart broken. You know, and that was the whole thing when we brought the song to MCA to put it on the album. The label didn't want me to record that song. They kept giving George a really hard time, saying it's inappropriate. She's only, you know, I mean, we had already recorded the record.
Yes.
But they really didn't want that song on the record because they really thought that the subject matter was just way over my head. And I disagreed. I was like, have you ever been around a 14-year-old who's in love? Are you kidding me?
Sweet words you whisper, didn't
Consecutive number one hit, and it was totally different from the first one. And when you had Could Have Been, you were still doing shopping malls, right?
Yes, I was doing shopping malls. That had taken off, and it was exciting to see the shopping malls go to the next level. I didn't even know what the next level was, but that was playing real venues and packed houses like Universal Amphitheater. But it was a little heartbreaking as well to be out of the mall because there was something so personal there, and it was very intimate. I mean, it got to be where it was crazy, and I could see people being smashed up against the barricade and things like that. So that, as an artist, really freaked me out, and I was like, people are getting hurt. This isn't fun anymore.
That's another side of the story there. But for the most part, it was a very positive experience.
It was extreme, because when we first started doing the malls, I would sing. A lot of people my age would come out on a Friday and see me sing. And again, I wasn't a huge star. So after I was finished singing, I could go grab a piece of pizza, sign a few autographs, and go walk the mall with everybody. And I made really good friends that I still have today.
Wow.
Because they'd come back the next day and go, all right, we'll come back later and see you. All right, cool, I'll be here.
We're going to play one more song from your debut album, which, by the way, sold a little over 4.1 million copies, I believe, something like that. 4.1 million copies, ladies and gentlemen. I believe you set a record for being the youngest female artist to top the Billboard charts with a debut album. That could very well be, because you were pretty young. You were 15 at the time?
I was 15. Again, all of that really, I didn't get it. I remember when George called me at home and I was doing my chores. I Think We're Alone Now had went to number one.
Yeah.
And he called me and he was, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm washing the dishes. I'm doing my chores. And he said, okay, you're not going to have to do that anymore. And he explained to me that I Think We're Alone Now was the biggest song in the country.
Yeah.
And that this was huge and I should be woohoo. And I kind of said, well, I'm thrilled, but I really have to finish these dishes. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to. I will be busted. And
yeah, but the thing is, it wasn't just that song. You were not just selling the singles. You were selling 4 million albums.
Right. You know, at 14, 15, even 16, I knew that was a lot.
Yeah.
And I knew that for the fact of, again, traveling and watching people come to my shows.
Yes.
And hearing my song on the radio and all of that. But really, it didn't fit into me how big of an accomplishment that is as an artist within the industry. until I was in my 20s. And, you know, I really got a concept of the music industry, started researching artists that I love, and realized that they had never had a number one record, or they had, you know, never accomplished some of the things, but yet they're legends. Isn't that crazy?
I want to say hello to the people on the Oldies Music Board, which is hosted by Mike Riccio, and the gentleman there named Frank Cavalier said, when you talk to Tiffany, ask her about I Saw Him Standing There. Ask her if she had to get permission to change the song from I Saw Her Standing There to I Saw Him Standing There. So you can answer that question.
That's a good question. I don't know. I hope we did.
The answer is she doesn't
know. For a long time.
The answer is she doesn't know, and now that we called it to everybody's attention, now she's worried.
Exactly.
Your remake of the Beatles, I Saw Her Standing There, and you did it as I Saw Him Standing There, actually got higher on the chart than the Beatles version of the same song, and from what I'm reading, that was the only time that that had ever happened, that somebody remade what was a Beatles single and got higher on the chart than the Beatles did with the same single.
No. So, now, see, I'm learning something now.
Well, all right. We have to put one thing in perspective there, though. The flip side of that Beatles single was something that had a moderate success. Let's call it I Want to Hold Your Hand. So I think that other one being the A-side may have taken away a little bit.
Saying that they're the Beatles is okay just to say that because I'm a huge fan. And, yeah, it's the Beatles.
Yes. But anyway, this is kind of...
I'm thankful to be Tiffany, but they're the Beatles.
Yes. This sounds nothing whatsoever like could have been. This is kind of a psychedelic version of that hit.
Well, it was the up-tempo dance version.
Dance version, right.
Real, like, you know, just go get them, you know. A lot of people from my age group knew who the Beatles are and were at that time, but
right. Maybe
they weren't really fans, but they became fans because of that song.
Wow.
And it was great because they were like, where'd that song come from? Oh, I know that's the Beatles song. My mom likes that song, but I wasn't really sure, but now I bought a Beatles record and it's really cool. So I was like, I told you, yeah.
Yeah.
symphony, and I saw him standing there, and we got one more record from what I call the then portion of your career, and then we're going to get to the now portion of your career. We're going to go to your second album, which was not called Tiffany. The second album was called, what was the second album called?
It was called Holding Old Friend's Hand.
Brain Freeze, Brain Freeze. From that album, you had another ballad become a hit called All This Time.
All This Time, I heard this song. I loved it. Loved the writers, Tim James and Steve McClintock. Mm-hmm. And when the song was brought to me, it's just, you know, it's a great ballad. It's one of those heartfelt ballads. I loved recording the song. Steve McClintock and I have become good friends over the years. And it was just an awesome time for me to be in the studio after, obviously, all the success and to go in to make my second record. And to be able to branch out a little bit as a vocalist. Definitely, that song is something that I really enjoy singing even now.
I know someday you
I think on my whole career, I think maybe people don't really know if I can sing still, which is so strange with the success of all this time and could have been. But, you know, people tend to kind of go, oh, can you still sing? Or, you know, was that really you? So these are the songs that I have grown up loving to sing even more because they really do showcase me as a vocalist. And again, they're just well-written songs. They have great stories of heartbreak and about, you know, being vulnerable and how much love is a vulnerable situation.
Right.
So I think I've grown into those songs very nicely as I've matured. So they're my favorite songs to sing.
You were having success at the same time that somebody named Debbie Gibson was having success. And according to many in the press, supposedly, and we're going to maybe set the record straight right now, I hope we do, there was this big feud between you and Debbie Gibson because you were kind of rivals. Now, was that really true, or was it just something that the press concocted?
No, that was just all hype. We never had any rivalry. We never even sat down and had a 10-minute conversation. So that was really funny to be living through all of that. I think more than anything, me personally speaking, it was a very strange time because at 16, I would travel the world and be asked questions like, where do you see yourself in 10 years? That is a hard question. Well, I hope to be doing music, and what do you mean by that? I mean, you know, I hadn't been set up for the waves and the wild ride of the industry and all of that. That was a hard question for me. And then the next question would be, and where do you see Deborah Gibson in the next 10 years?
Yeah,
do you still see each other doing music together? And I was like, I'm trying to answer for myself, let alone her career. So I think for us sometimes it became somewhat of an annoyance to have to account for yourself and another person that you haven't even had a chance to sit down and have a girl chat with. Now we laugh about it a lot. We've seen other teen stars and other female celebrities like, you know, Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears and all these different people.
Yeah.
And they continually do that battle thing, which is so funny to Deb and I because, you know, we're like, oh, we were just the first run. This is just something that they do.
Recently, you and Debbie worked together on a project.
Well, we did a movie together that was very successful called Megapython versus Gatoroid. And we actually sang together for the first time at the Canal Room in New York.
How recently did you move?
January of this year. We have never performed together, ever. I think it was wonderful for our fans. We ended up doing our separate shows, but then we came together and sang Don't Stop Believing, Journey.
Oh.
I'm a huge Journey fan, so that was a great song and has a lot of energy and people love it. So we had a really fun time doing that.
At one point, don't you and Debbie have a big fight?
We do. I think you can still YouTube it, actually.
I think it is on YouTube. It was kind of like what they had these two ladies in the movie, The Turning Point, and they had these two dancers, these ballet dancers were part, and watching you and Debbie have this fight. I said, oh, maybe there was a rivalry, but then it really was. It was just fun. It was just fun stuff.
Well, let's see, who was that? That was Shirley MacLaine.
MacLaine and
Anne Bancroft.
So I will tell Deb that we're compared to that as actresses. She'll get a kick out of it.
I think it's about when I watched that scene, I watched The Turning
Point. Valid in this Megapython versus Gatoroid. We kind of compared the fight scene to the really good Dynasty, like a really good Dallas moment.
There was some there, but
it was very much like that kind of angle.
That brings us to the last portion of our interview right now. We're going to discuss your brand new album, which is called Rose Tattoo.
And this has kept you real busy.
I have not stopped since December, since Christmas. I have been going, and it feels great to be, you know, again, I don't want to say doing what I want to do or doing what I've always wanted to do, because I've enjoyed every stage of my career and all the music I've put my heart into, and I've learned so much from it. But again, with Rose Tattoo, this project, I really have been on this journey to go back into country music for probably about 10 years now, even though I went off and did dance albums. I lived in England for a while.
Yes, you did.
In my mind, I was always kind of like, well, one day when I find the right musicians, when I find the right producer, I've got to be a better songwriter before I go back to Nashville. But that is the end goal. So I've been plugging away and doing the dance stuff, writing a song like Higher, which was on the Billboard charts 3 years ago.
Yes.
And having that opportunity, and then writing some on the dance album, writing The Color of Silence, which came out in 2000. These were all things that I started feeling more confident and becoming a better songwriter. So everyone that I've worked with in the last 10 years is, it really made this happen for me.
Yeah.
They've been really patient with me and helped me grow as an artist and, again, as a songwriter. And even, you know, the vision of how to handle this new album.
The title, Rose Tattoo, what does that refer to?
Well, I have many rose tattoos myself, personally. I got my first tattoo when I was 15, actually, and hid it for all those years. No one knew.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up with a rose tattoo, like kind of a bracelet on my wrist, many years later, probably, oh gosh, when I was 18, something like that.
Okay.
And there's just something about roses, and I've collected them throughout the years. I always say now, don't go get one tattoo because they are addictive, and then before you know it, you think you'll just get one, and then you have many.
You co-wrote 7 of the 8 songs. It was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee. And we're going to listen to excerpts from a few of the songs that I picked out. And we're going to close with the single, which is Feel the Music. I'm going to play a little bit of Crazy Girls, which is a duet with Lindsay Lawler.
Yes.
I have to tell you, there's a line in the song, bring the boys to their knees like Thelma and Louise.
Yes, bring the boys to the knees like Thelma and Louise, one of my favorite movies of all time.
Crazy Girls. I'm Ronnie Allen talking to one of the girls, Tiffany, whose life is crazy right now. This album is about relationships. It's about who you are. You kind of have your heart on your sleeve in this album. I've listened to it a few times. And song number 4 is called He Won't Miss Me. And then song number 5 is All Over You.
All Over You. I wrote it about somebody who left a relationship and realized the grass was not greener on the other side kind of thing. And now she is back to say, look, I know that I left. I know that I couldn't make the promises, and I kind of walked out on this. But now I'm back, and I want to love all over you. I just want to be here. My promises are true. And that's why in the bridge, we say that if you didn't love me, you would have never let me go. This guy loved her enough to say, all right, go on and do your thing, hoping that you'll be back. And here I am. I'm back, and, you know, if I didn't love you, my heart would have never let me home. So she knows for sure that that's her man now.
Song called Just Love Me.
Yes.
And that has a line, "Even though I drive you a little insane." Can we play a little bit of Just Love Me?
That would be great.
Anyone can make me smile. Hold me close a little while. No one can love me like I need. I walk these streets enough to know. Eventually the cracks will show. And truth brings me to my knees. Cause we're all made of broken things. Baby, just love me, yeah. Even though I drive you a little insane, be my man and follow the way to stay. And love me, yeah. For my moon and stars, for my battle scars, all my broken hearts. Baby, just love me.
And before we get to the last song, here's a little bit of the only song that you did not co-write. This one was written by Tommy Wright, all by his lonesome.
All by his lonesome.
Love You Good.
Well, Love You Good is about a Cajun witch. It is a story that's kind of, it's mysterious, and we are both really big, Tommy and I are huge fans of True Blood. Mm-hmm. And when he originally wrote it, he was hoping I would sing it and maybe we could pitch it to True Blood, just our favorite show. But when I heard it, I was like, okay, that's a possibility as well, but I want it for my album.
Uh-huh.
This is a cool song, man. And I started singing Love You Good around town here in Nashville, and people just go crazy. It's so different. It's so unique. And he's my buddy, and I wanted to do a song right. So, you know, it didn't bother me that I didn't write on this song. I was like, no, it's a good song. It's got to be on it.
You want to dedicate this to your buddy?
I will. This goes out to my writing buddy, Tommy Wright.
And the song is called?
Love You Good.
Tiffany's new CD, and I mean new, this just came out, called Rose Tattoo. You're going to be doing some live gigs to promote this?
Oh, yes. I'm going to be going out on the road. I go next month, and it'd probably be good. The weather here in Nashville has been a little crazy. I have, like, this allergy, so I apologize if I'm going the whole interview.
Yeah, I'll cut all of that stuff out.
Cool.
So we'll have about a minute and a half of the interview left. Only kidding. You sound fine. So you're going to go all over the country?
I'm going to be going all over the country. Just booking things now. And you can always go to tiffanytunes.com and check out the tour schedule. I'm on Facebook. I Twitter a lot. Not a whole lot, but I do Twitter.
You tweet?
I tweet. Yes, I tweet. It's very hard for me to say that. I tweet. Because, you know, back in the 80s and stuff and growing up, like, you're such a tweet. We used to say things like, you're such a twit. You know, it meant like you were stupid. So it's really hard, this tweet, twit.
Well, wait, if you're on...
I think I'm confessing that I'm really stupid.
You could be Twiffany.
Yes, exactly. So I always just say, I do Twitter.
So she twitters, ladies and gentlemen, she twitters.
I do.
In front of
yes.
all those people, you Twitter?
Yes. I know, it sounds strange. I still am having problems with it.
Are you on Facebook as Tiffany?
I'm actually under Tiffany Darwish. We were just talking about this last night at dinner. My name, when you Google me, it comes up with all these other people but me.
Yeah.
And I'm somewhere down there in the last pile. So it's very hard to find me, but I'm under Tiffany Darwish for Facebook.
Okay.
And I always tell people just go to TiffanyTunes.com.
Tiffany, I cannot thank you enough for taking a few moments to do this with me. It's very, very special. This is for the Jersey Girl Sing website. We're going to put this interview up, and people all over the world forever going to be able to listen to it on demand. I'm not trying to make you nervous, but...
But you are.
Oh, okay. Then I've accomplished my purpose. Yes, I'm only kidding, of course. Fans, one thing we didn't point out is when your records were so big in the United States, they were also big in England, in Canada, in Japan. I mean, your records were selling all over the world.
Yes.
We're going to close with the single, which you co-wrote with Julie Forrester and Dee Briggs.
Yes.
Anything you want to say about Feel the Music?
Well, this is, it's a fun song. It's a song about a girl who's going out to a club, and she just wants to own it. And I think that, speaking for the ladies, we always feel like that, no matter what stage of our life we're in. I'm a mom, and my son's 19, and I still get together with my girlfriends, even though I love my husband, and we just do a safe girls' night out. But when we walk in that club, we definitely, we definitely want to own it. So that's what the song's about.
Ronnie remembers, Ronnie remembers, Ronnie remembers.